The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. There's lots of versions of the story of Bodhidharma coming from India to China, and Reverend Hubert has translated a section in Great Master Dogen's Gyoji where he has very specific information about that. So I wanted to read some of that. It was at the behest of the Venerable Hanyatara, Prajnatara, that the first ancestor of China came from the west to the eastern land. In other words, he was asked by his teacher in India to go to China. During the frosts and spring of his 3 years in sailing the seas, how could the winds and snows have been the only miseries? How the clouds and mists must have billowed up over the rolling waves. He was attempting to go to an unknown land. Such would not have occurred to ordinary people who hold dear their life and limb. This must have been his ceaseless practice that sprang from his great compassion to earnestly transmit the Dharma and instruct those deluded by their passions. That willingness to step off into the unknown is what training is all about. And his is probably one of the most dramatic examples of that, because this was 1,500 years ago. And you couldn't just hop on a jet and get there in a couple of hours. It took him 3 years. And I can imagine that the boats were all that comfortable. And this is from the chapter of Great Master Dogen on ceaseless practice. And he being the example of that, the paramount example of that. It was so because it was he himself who transmitted the Dharma. And it was so because it is the whole universe that transmits the Dharma. And it was so because the whole universe in all 10 directions is the words and ways of the truth. And it is so because the whole universe in all 10 directions is Bodhidharma himself. And it was so because the whole universe in all 10 directions is the whole universe in all 10 directions. Dogen has a lovely way of saying things that you're not supposed to be able to understand. Because he's talking about that which is beyond the intellectual understanding here. The transmission of the truth has to do with the direct knowledge of that which is unborn and undying. And it's knowing that which is unconditioned, seeing that the truth that he knows and he transmitted is the truth that transcends our tiny little mind's way of looking at things. We look at things from this filter of self, and then we see things in a distorted way through those filters of greed and anger and fear. And when you let go of those, then you see things a little bit differently. And that subtle little difference, that switching the mind from the noise, the static of self, to that little shift where it's quiet. And listening to something else other than our greeds, angers, and fears is where the heart opens. What karmic conditions in any life are not a royal palace, and what royal palace does not serve as spiritual training grounds? Remember, Master talked about what she brought back from Japan was peace of mind. She sometimes talked about it as luxury of mind. And that's what I think he's referring to here. That all of us have this ability to know that our original tranquility and peace of mind. And we cloud it over with being focused on the karmic consequences that bring up the fears and the angers and the greeds. And so we don't see that which is underneath there. Because it was he himself who instructed those deluded by their passions, he had no fears or doubts, nor did he act from timidity or awe. Look at that picture. If you want to see certainty, no doubts there. That's what he's talking about. Because it was the whole universe that instructed those deluded by their passions, he had no fears, nor did he act from timidity or awe. Leaving behind forever his father's kingdom, he fitted out a large ship, crossed the southern seas, and arrived at Kwangtung province, which is modern-day Canton. Undoubtedly, the crew was a large one, and the monks to serve his needs were many, but chroniclers have failed to record this. Upon his reaching the shore, no one there knew him. It was the 21st day of the 6th lunar month of the 8th year of the Putang era, during the Liang Dynasty, which translates as August 3rd, 527. The governor of Kwangtung province, a man named Cao Ong, made a show of extending to him all the courtesies of a host, giving him an audience and plying him with entertainments. Suang Ho then wrote an account to inform Emperor Wu about him, for Suang Ho was punctilious in his duties. When Emperor Wu saw the report, he was delighted and sent a messenger to invite Bodhidharma to pay him a visit. That was the first day of the 10th lunar month of that year, which is November 9th of 527. When the first ancestor arrived at the city of Qingning, he had an audience with the Emperor Wu of Liang, whereupon the emperor asked him, "Since the time when we ascended to the throne, we have excelled in building of temples, the copying of scriptures, and the permitting of both men and women to become monks, that such deeds must be quite beyond keeping a record of. So what merit have we accrued?" The master replied, "There's no merit in any of these." The emperor asked, why is there no merit in them? The master replied, "They are merely the results achieved by ordinary people and those in lofty positions who follow the lesser course. Such is the cause of defiling one's deeds. It is like a shadow following a form. Even though it exists, it is not the real thing." I'm sure the emperor was not happy with that answer. Very often people think that when they give something, it's a contract. This is a perfect example of that. He wants merit for his gifts. And when you're giving something with the idea that there's an exchange here, it isn't a gift from the heart. And this is why Bodhidharma was trying to tell him that that's not the way to do it. Emperors usually don't like to be told they're wrong. And I'm sure he's got lots of monks in the country who would tell him how much merit he was gaining. But there was one here who was willing to tell him the truth. And that's an enormously kind thing when somebody's actually willing to tell us the truth. Because it's very easy to have our relationships based on shared delusions, where we feed each other's egos and delusions and ideas and opinions. And it's very difficult to realize that when we're confronted with things that don't agree with us, that perhaps we have something to learn. And that degree of humility, the willingness to learn, is a really important part of how it is that we step through that door to the unknown. But he notes here, Bodhidharma notes that when you give in that way, you're causing your deeds to be defiled. Because the gift itself could be quite pure if you weren't wanting something in return for it. So the gifts that he was making were actually quite wonderful. But he defiled them by his wanting something from that, that grasping. The source of suffering is that grasping, that wanting something. So instead of being able to give freely, you know, he's bargaining with the eternal. Beautiful image. It's like a shadow following a form. Even though it exists, it is not the real thing. A really lovely way of putting it. Because that's how delusion is. You know, when we give something with the idea of getting something, we're holding on to a delusion of self. And it's like the shadow following the form. Lovely image of what that delusion is. Our master used to quote, man stands in his own shadow and wonders why it's dark. Only he can turn around. Master Kota and I spent some time in the library in Vancouver trying to find the source of that quote, and Reverend Master was the only one that we could find and quoted it. The emperor then asked, "What then is true merit?" The master answered, "One, immaculacy, immaculately wise discernment, being wondrous and fully realized, one's body being naturally unbounded and tranquil. Merit like this is not sought by the worldly minded." That's a lovely translation. We usually hear it as there is no holiness or there's nothing, there is emptiness. But it's much more, his explanation is really quite wonderful here. But because he's very specific about one's immaculately wise discerning being, wondrous and fully realized, is the true merit. Because if what we get from the giving is the giving up of the self, this is what we know. The real gift, as our Master Ji used to say, is giving up that which we never wanted anyway. It's the giving up of our own suffering. And that's the point at one realizes this immaculately wise discernment. And it's there all the time. It's not something that we get. It's something we have to then take off this filter of self in order to realize that it's just right there. The emperor also asked, "What is the paramount truth of the holy teaching?" The master replied, "Since this is devoid of any limits, it is beyond holiness. It's reality as it is, just reality as it is." The emperor asked, "Who, pray, is the one who confronts us?" In other words, who are you to tell me this? Who do you think you are? And Reverend Hubert has a really lovely translation of this. The master replied, "I have not made his acquaintance." And Reverend Hubert's little footnote on that is, "My true nature is beyond anything my intellect can directly know." In other words, the I isn't going to be able to know this. It's not the self that knows. The emperor had failed to awaken to what Bodhidharma was pointing to, and the master realized that the occasion was not opportune. So So, on the 19th day of the 10th lunar month, November 27th, he snuck away to the north of the Yangtze River and arrived at Luoyang on the 23rd day of the 11th month of that year, December 31. He lodged temporarily in Shorinji, or Shaolin Su, the temple on Mount Susan, or Sushan, where he sat all day long, silently facing a wall. I think I like Reverend Hubert's rendition of that. One of the scriptures that we did today mentioned the four practices. And I want to read this teaching that Bodhidharma wrote on those four practices. And this was from a translation by Red Pine on the Zen teachings of Bodhidharma. And I heard Reverend Master give a talk on these to the monks many years ago, and had made a couple of notes. Many roads lead to the path, but basically there are only two, reason and practice. And the way Reverend Master Jiyu talked about that, she said you can understand reason simply as the truth. It's not reason in the sense of your intellectual mind reasoning things out here. It has to do with the Eightfold Path, what it means by right view, right thought, right understanding. Because it's the view that allows you to see the unconditioned, in contrast to looking at everything through the filters of our karmically conditioned habits. When you see through that which is unconditioned, then your understanding is clear and you know that which is immaculate and tranquil. To enter by reason or by direct understanding of the truth means to realize the essence through instruction and to believe that all living things share the same true nature, which isn't apparent because it's shrouded by sensation and delusion. The six thieves are the six senses. These are the places that we identify a self with. And it's like getting, it's like how a prison scatters light in all directions. Comes in white light and it then has all these different colors. And it's not that all those colors aren't there, it's just that we see them, we filter the truth through that kind of prism of self, and so it creates this twisting of the light. And the senses are the places where we grasp at an idea of self. Form, sensation, thought, activity, and consciousness are the places that we try to identify. This is my body. These are my feelings, these are my thoughts, these are my ideas, this is my action, this is my mind, this is my consciousness, this is all the places that we put a little my in there, and that keeps us from seeing that maybe, as Dogen says, this very body is not my own. This very mind is not my own. Those who turn from delusion back to reality, who meditate on walls, the absence of self and other, the oneness of mortal and sage, and who remain unmoved even by scriptures, and are in complete and unspoken agreement with the truth. Without moving, without effort, they enter, we say, by reason or by the truth. It's a nice point. It's not so much what you do, it's what you don't do. To enter by practice refers to four all-inclusive practices. And the way he's translated them here is suffering and justice, adapting to conditions, seeking nothing, and practicing the Dharma. This is another way of talking about the Four Noble Truths, that suffering exists. There is a cause for suffering, which is the attachment to the grasping, to an idea of self. There's a cure for suffering, and that cure is the practice of the Eightfold Path. Suffering and justice. That's how we view our karmic consequences, as in, this is not fair. When those who search for the path encounter adversity, they should think to themselves, in countless ages gone by, I've turned from the essential to the trivial and wandered through all manner of existence. Often angry, without cause, and guilty of numberless transgressions. Now, though I do no wrong, I'm punished by my past. Neither gods nor men. Can foresee when an evil deed will bear its fruit. I accept it with an open heart and without complaint of injustice. We had a memorial yesterday, and one of the ladies who came was talking about her husband, and he had read in the Dalai Lama's teaching that he said when somebody does something that causes you to get angry or upset, you should say to them, thank you for giving me this opportunity to learn patience. And she said he used to say that to her quite frequently. And he doesn't say it so much now. But it's the same idea of accepting the consequences, the things that happen to us, where there's no immediate cause for somebody to experience somebody's anger or to have fear arise or whatever. And if we can accept that as karmic consequences from who knows where, and realize that we're just the vehicle through which these consequences get cleansed. It takes the me out of it. But so often we take it personally, and as a result of that, carry on the angers and the fears and the frustrations. And that willingness to accept the karmic consequences. The sutra says, when you meet with adversity, don't be upset, because it makes sense. Not immediate sense to our intellectual and emotional minds. A sense in the long-term view. That the things that happen for a purpose, and that purpose is to teach. Karma isn't there to punish. We're punishing ourselves by that clinging to the suffering. And we have that same ability to let go that we have to cling. It's just doing the other thing. It's the turning around and facing the light. It's turning around and facing the fears. Turning around and facing those things that we think are really awful. But it's going through that door to the unknown, doing that which we haven't done in the past. That's what takes the courage. There's a lovely line in the Metta scripture where it says you need courage, fortitude, patience, and understanding in order to deal with the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. And that courage is a very simple little thing. It's not being courageous and going out and killing millions of people. It's having to do with facing those things that look difficult. And really examining, you know, what it is that's difficult here, you know, what's painful, well, what can't I look at? And when we start looking at those things, we realize that they're not such a big deal after all. We don't understand their essential emptiness until we actually experience it. And that's what that patience and fortitude is about. Stick with that long enough to be still enough with those things that are difficult to actually learn what it is that you need to learn. And they're going to keep coming up until we do this. It's guaranteed. They don't just go away because you're a nice person. We really have to look at those things, and we have to see that there's a subtle little shift in how we look at those things. Do we look at them through that filter of stillness? Do we go to that place within our mind and heart that is undisturbed? Do we look through the eyes of compassion? We have a choice. We can do that. You don't really know you can do that until you've actually done that. But all of us, on one level or another, have done that, because in order just to get here, we have to listen to something that comes from a place of stillness. And that's what you have to return to in order to really be able to clean up the karma. And it's not something that you can't do. It's just something you resist doing. And that resistance is really very painful, because that's the clinging to this shadow. And the shadow can't be clung to, because it has no substance. That's why the clinging is so painful. You're holding on to emptiness. The second one is adapting to conditions, that is to see the cause of suffering. That's the same as understanding anicca, that there's no self and that everything is changing. Anatta. Adapting to conditions. As mortals, we're ruled by conditions, not by ourselves. All the suffering and joy we experience depend on conditions. In other words, the outward, we're always looking outside. It's always old so-and-so who's the source of my anger, not this so-and-so. It's always somebody out there they're the problem. Or it could be the weather. We had a lovely ceremony the other night. We circumambulated the stupa. And just as we got out there, it started a very light sprinkle. And then it really let loose. And then as soon as we got through, it stopped. A little message from Ho'un Dharma Cloud, G.U. If you're worried about the weather, then just go stand in the rain. It's not all, it was quite wonderful, actually. If we should be blessed by some great reward, such as fame or fortune, it's the fruit of a seed planted by us in the past. When condition changes, it ends. Why delight in existence? But while success and failure depend on conditions, the mind neither waxes nor wanes. Those who remain unmoved by the wind of joy silently follow the path. Being ruled by conditions, is to still be attached to our old karmic ways of doing things and delighting in the things that happen that cause us to feel good. Well, that's fine. But also delighting in the things that we need to learn from is also fine. But what River Master Ji referred to as the luxury of mind is the place that is undisturbed by conditions. When things are going well, it's there. When things are not going well, it's there. And our job is to keep using that as our anchor, to come back to that stillness. This is why it's so helpful to meditate every day. Because that meditation reminds us that we can go to that place that's undisturbed. But we have to choose to do that. It's an active choice. Then we get up and we go on with our daily life and we forget all about it. But hopefully after a while it sinks in. And we notice that we're not meditating. And that's actually what the meditation is. It's to notice all the places where you're not meditating. Reverend Sheridan said he hadn't heard what I said yesterday about doing the best you can is to see where you can do better. And that's an important part of being able to be on that edge of doing the best you can is always, there's always another step to take. If you can't see that there's more to do, then you're going to get stuck in your complacency and think, oh, well, it's fine now. I don't have to make an effort. But in fact, there's always that next step. And there's that lovely line from the Sharangama scripture that says, that which understands the error is not itself in error. So to be able to look at ourselves and see where it is that we get the self in the way, that's the Buddha nature. That's the mind that's undisturbed. That's the mind that's pointing to you that you could do a little better here. You forgot a couple of details. You're a little sloppy about this. There's work to be done here. Yeah, there was a little greed there, fear there. And, well, you could have done a little better. And that's very important, to be able to leave room for that next step. Space. The final frontier. That's what compassion is like. It's like all the space in the universe is compassion. Because it embraces everything, it holds everything. You can give it a name, but it doesn't have a form. It doesn't have substance. It's not a thing. But emptiness, why it's easier for Buddhists to talk about emptiness. Because emptiness has that, allows everything to be. Allows that expansion. In contrast to the black hole where there's no space. We fall into the black hole, our own little personal black hole all the time. It's very heavy and dense. No space for compassion, no space to learn. The third, seeking nothing. A lovely line. And finally we grasp nothing, for words inaccurate will be. Another way of saying seeking nothing is to be content with what's going on now. And to be content is also to see that there's more that can be done. The content is not complacency. The content is not being kind of self-satisfied. It's the contentment has to do with being still enough to be having our cage unrattled, when in fact the cage may be rattling. But it's our choosing to sit still in the midst of that, realizing that there is this place that is essentially undisturbed. And when the cage is rattling, to go there. It's a little clue. That's the seeking of nothing. People of this world are deluded. They're always longing for something, always, in a word, seeking. But the wise wake up. They choose reason over custom. Reason here, again, is not intellectually reasoning. And custom has to do more with karmic conditioning. It's choosing to be at peace with the truth instead of grasping on to the angers and fears and greeds. That's how I understand that sentence. They fix their minds on the sublime and let their bodies change with the seasons. All phenomena are empty. They contain nothing worth desiring. Calamity forever alternates with prosperity. To dwell in the three realms is to dwell in a burning house. That's a reference to the Lotus Scripture, where the Buddha uses the analogy of the burning house, and he's the father calling to the children in the burning house, and he offers them all sorts of toy carts, and then when they do come out, he gives them the real thing. It's an analogy for skillful means. To have a body is to suffer. Does anyone with a body know peace? And you don't have to make it any worse at all. It's enough going on with the body as it is. Try to be kind to it. Those who understand this detach themselves from all that exists and stop imagining or seeking anything. I remember asking this high school class to define suffering, and a young lady says, wanting things to be other than they are. That wanting, that grasping, that trying, the non-acceptance of reality on its terms. And all these karmic conditionings, all the external events, are these conditions that are external to us and over which we have no control. But the choice to let go of the wanting is the one thing we have control over. And we can choose to let go of that at any time. And keeping choosing is the important aspect. It's a process of choosing. Because the old karma keeps arising, and our old karma can work on us at any time. And we have to keep working on that process. The delusion is that, oh, once I get there, I've got it made. But the process is the goal. There isn't some place to get to. It is a process of choosing to constantly let go of the suffering, let go of the fears. Let go of the angers, let go of the greeds, let go of the wanting. So we have to see all those places where we're wanting things and lusting after things and distracted by things and angry about things and fearful of things. And keep looking at that, seeing that those are the choices that we have, to see them and to let go. Gently being compassionate. The sutra says, to seek is to suffer. To seek nothing is bliss. When you seek nothing, you're on the path. But the path implies that it has to be walked. It doesn't do much good to stumble over the path and then go off into the bushes again. Even though I sometimes think that I only know the path for a step or two. When we're off into the bramble bushes again, we know to go in a different direction. But it's the walking of the path that needs to be emphasized, which is the fourth truth here, practicing the Dharma. The Dharma is the truth that all natures are pure. Hmm. By this truth, all appearances are empty. Defilement and attachment, subject and object, don't exist. The sutras say, the Dharma includes no being because it's free from the impurity of being. And the Dharma includes no self because it's free from the impurity of self. And it's precisely because we create suffering that we are brought to the practice. The suffering itself is pure because it's the thing that brings us, causes us to look for something more. But if we indulge it, it just creates more of the same sort of thing that we didn't want in the first place. But it is not outside of the Buddha nature. And since that which is real includes nothing worth begrudging, they give their body, life, and property in charity without regret, without the vanity of giver, gift, or recipient, and without bias or attachment. That's what the emperor didn't get. And to eliminate impurity, they teach others, but without becoming attached to form. Thus, through their own practice, they're able to help others and to purify the way of enlightenment. The way of enlightenment. And as with charity, they also practice the other virtues. But while practicing the six virtues to eliminate delusion, they practice nothing at all. This is what is meant by practicing the Dharma. And it does a beautiful job of singing this offertory today. Thank you very much. I just want to read it too. Let it sink in on another level. The Dharma body of the Buddha cannot be seen so long as one is within duality, for it is beyond birth and death, filling all things. Out of compassion for all living things, the Buddha appeared in the form and figure of a human being. For this great act, we bow in gratitude and pray that we may be able to illuminate our minds from delusion. On this 8th day of October, we commemorate the death of the first ancestor, Engaku Daishi Bodhidharma. We are gathered here to offer incense, flowers, candles, cakes, fruit, tea, and other good food, and the merits of the recitation of the litany of Bodhidharma Bodhisattva, and these invocations out of gratitude for his great compassion. Bodhidharma was the son of the king of southern India, and he was very imposing in appearance. Although he was the possessor of many jewels, he realized that they were not the true and shining treasure and were utterly valueless. So he left behind worldly things and began monastic training. He went to China and there became the first ancestor, showing others the way as does Kanzian Bodhisattva. Because of his deep desire to rescue all beings, he traveled many roads and crossed the sea to China. He was the 28th person after Shakyamuni to receive the truth, and this highest of all possessions he carried to China with him. He did not try to explain the Dharma in words. Instead, by just keeping the precepts and doing silent meditation, he taught all around him. It was King Bhute who called him to China, and because of their conversation, Bodhidharma sat facing a wall for 9 years. When the snow lay deep upon the ground, the Buddha received a truly worthy follower. When we think wholeheartedly of the merit of his actions, we see that it has illuminated 1,000 autumns and still warmly embraces his uncountable family in the Dharma. Just as one branch of a tree can produce 5 flowers, so his transmission has flowered and its perfume fills countless places in which Buddha's training is being truly undergone. It's lovely. Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.